Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I'm Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by Barnabas Piper and Ronnie Martin. Boys, we are inching ever closer to our live event in Louisville on October 23rd. So, if you're a listener to this podcast, and if you are, we appreciate your listenership. Mark October 23rd on your calendar. This will be in a to be determined hipster coffee shop location in Louisville, and we're real excited about that. And Pipe, as long as we're doing business, let's talk about our sponsor for today.
Yes, we've got Nav Press back for I think a fourth episode now. So they again reminding you, reintroducing you, encouraging you to go check out the works of Jerry Bridges. Bridges is a classic, just the influencer of so many people who have shaped our pastors and people who we look up to. So also just an incredibly godly, humble man. The two books that they have highlighted are The Blessing of Humility and The Pursuit of Holiness. Both of those are timeless and timely. I think you can be both at the same time. So very pertinent for us, but go check those out. The Blessing of Humility, The Pursuit of Holiness. Those are from Nav Press by Jerry Bridges. You can get them wherever you buy books. Both of them are books that they're the kind you kind of read slow and chew on a little bit because they really work on the heart. They're not sort of quick fixes on different habits and how-tos and things like that, but he has a knack for bringing the gospel, the work of Christ, the resurrection, the character of God into everyday life and how it plays out. So strongly encourage readers to check those out.
Nice. Now, boys, I've got something I want to get off my chest here, man. And this was a listener-suggested topic, and it couldn't have come at a better time for me. So I'll be the first to admit, I don't love other people's kids, right? So I'm not the guy who's like, I want our house in the neighborhood to be like, you know, romper room where everybody's kids come and just feel comfortable. You know what I mean? Like I have to really like put myself out there to invite other people's kids over. So we did this recently. Okay. And you know, this family, they brought their kids over. You know, we made some food for the kids. We made kind of a big deal out of, you know, this is your meal and it's fun. And these kids, they didn't eat any of the food. Right. So like they were like special ordering. They were ordering like off the menu. Like, can you do this? Can you do this? Like, I'm, you know, I'm trying to eat clean. I'm vegan. You know, it wasn't that bad, but like,
just throw a carrot at them.
Yeah, exactly, man. Like, dude, when I was a kid, every day in the summer for lunch, I made myself a bologna sandwich or a peanut butter sandwich. Right. And I watched The Price is Right. And then I went and played with my buddies like every summer. And these kids, man, they want like a pre-salad. They want some like kale, some arugula. You know, they're like Brooklyn hipsters, these kids. So they come into my house, they special order some stuff, and then they start carrying it all over the place, right? Like we have kind of a strict like you only eat in the kitchen or the dining room kind of thing going on in our house, and these kids, man, they're like carrying the plate. Yeah, we're food Nazis, man. But, wow. But dude, they got the plate, they got the watermelon going all over the house, and I'm envisioning this stuff all over the sofa, and so the topic is, what's up with these excuses that parents make for their kids being awful, right? Because this happens, and I think Big R, this goes hand in hand with the like good job buddy culture thing that you brought up a couple of weeks ago on this very same program, in which you suggested that the parents kind of their kids can do no wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, dude, when I was a kid, if I'd gone over to somebody's house and been like, you know, no, Mrs. Warner, I don't want hot dogs. I'd rather have a filet wrapped in
your dad bacon. Your dad would have beat you up if he knew you had said
oh,
that.
Dude, yeah, it would have been the end of me. You know, that would have been the end of me ever playing over there again. I don't know, man. Times have changed. You guys talk about this.
Yeah, I don't. Gosh, it's. Yeah, these are tough ones. The whole thing about like parents not being able to deal with their kid being like just a wicked tyrant. I don't know. Like I remember – so I go back and I remember – I kind of remember my pops, right? And one of the big lines that used to get thrown around – maybe it's still thrown around. I don't know. But one of the big lines that used to get thrown around that my dad actually used on occasion was don't tell me how to raise my kids. Remember that? Like, nobody tells me how to raise my kids. Uh-huh. So there's this idea that I think, like, even when you deal with other parents and, like the kid is, like, literally in the background doing the worst thing that a kid has, like, ever done in the history of kiddom. But, like, you feel like you can say anything because I feel like there's just
this culture. Have any jurisdiction over it.
Like, you have zero jurisdiction, even though you're looking at the parent going, like, you see that he's literally, like, almost engaging in the act of, like, murder right now.
He's urinating on my carpet and you're not
right, but you're, like, not allowed to say anything and you're – it has to be kind of this, like, hands off. I just have to act like everything's great. You know, oh, your kid's so awesome.
Yeah, like, I don't how he's doing, like, naked parkour in my living room, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know. And then, like, to get the parents to actually admit that their kids are doing something, like, bratish or jerkish or crazy-ishness, it almost seems like you're not allowed to do it. But then at the same time, the conflict is, like, why don't they know that? Because here's the thing, like, when my kid used to act up, I'd be like – like, I mean, my kid's acting up and I want you to tell me if my kid's acting up and, I want to deal with it correctly because, man, I don't have this sort of thing where nobody's allowed to tell me my kid's a tyrant. If the kid's being a tyrant, I want to know about it because I want to deal with it. But like, today it's like there's a sensitivity now which doesn't allow you to even engage.
There's an assumption in the nobody tells me how to raise my kids or don't tell me how to raise my kids in that you're actually raising your kids. Right. As opposed to like having free range monkeys who just do whatever they want. And so, but I completely agree that you can't call out somebody else for not doing anything. Like it's not that they're doing something wrong. It's that they are not doing anything. And the listener who asked this question was like, what about the excuses parents make? So like, if you were going to be like, excuse me, your son is doing naked parkour and urinating in my living room, they would just be like, oh, Johnny's off his Ritalin or whatever. And like, and you're like, fine. He's naked and peeing in my living room. I don't care I don't care about his medication. Do something as a parent. So it's the excuses and just sort of that, like, is it a lack of awareness? Is it a lack of standards? Is it just sheer laziness? Like, I don't know. Like, I may be overly self-conscious about this, but when we take our kids anywhere, come hell or high water, I want them to be the best behaved kids in that place. When we go to a restaurant, like, you sit at the table, you don't run around, you don't raise your voice, you don't, you know, don't drop things on the floor. And like, I'm not a Nazi. They do it now because they've learned how to do it. But like, I want to leave no impression on anybody around me. I don't want to leave a good impression. I just want them not to notice my kids.
Dude, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You don't want to be embarrassed. Sometimes you get an excuse like, so the kids like parkouring all over the living room and sometimes they'll be like, oh, he's taking karate. He's just practicing. You know, he thinks he's a ninja. I'm like, I'll tell you right now, he's not a ninja.
Can I go karate chop him?
Yeah, right. Like, does he want to spar? You know?
Like, I don't know.
Like, my living room with that.
So here's what's weird, right? So Melissa and I, Melissa being my wife, like, we only ever had one kid, right? So we had a very – so this is different than you guys. So we had a very quiet house, and we really valued a quiet house. And when you have one kid, they have nobody to fight with or argue with or fight with. So it you can kind of maintain that level of control in a sense, you know what I mean? So I think for us, right, it made us – so when we were around – like when we were with family and all my other brothers and sisters have more than one kid or were with friends and they each have like 9 kids each because they're good reformed families, you know, and all that type of thing. It's really weird because like it just – we were so much more aware of like the level of chaos and noise that was surrounding us. And so we had to really be careful about that because for us it was like, well, we just – like by default with just having one kid, we don't have that. But it made us way more sensitive and aware of it. So part of us was saying, well, we just don't even understand. Like, dude, if you have 2, 3, 4, 9 kids, like it's just going to be chaotic and kids are going to be doing crazy things. And then what happens is parents just have to go, yeah, that's just Johnny being Johnny. And I can't just stop all the kids from being kids. So what do you want me to do with that?
The idea that if you have a lot of kids, it is chaos and like out of control is a notion that did not exist, I don't know, 20 years ago.
That's true.
I am one of 5 kids, you know, so I grew up with 3 older brothers and we adopted my sister when I was 12. And I can tell you, My mom did not stand for chaos. A house of four boys and not a lot of chaos. Now, yeah. She would send us outside in the yard, and we could be as rambunctious as we wanted in our own home. But, like, if we went to somebody else's house and were rambunctious,
right.
it would not be a happy day. She's the oldest of 10 kids. And I know for a fact her parents didn't put up with a lot of nonsense either. So it is a matter of, like, it's – people just quit disciplining their kids.
It's parenting, man. It's back down to parenting. It really is.
People quit. Yeah. And but the idea is, like, people are afraid that discipline is going to harm their kids. I mean, whatever psychobabble nonsense that is. But in doing that, they have – they've lost the idea that disciplining your kids is teaching them how to respect other people. Like when I call my kids out for misbehaving, it's not because they made me mad. It's because they disrespected somebody else, or they something about their attitude, their heart, their expression was hurtful to somebody else. Like if my kids are fighting, I don't yell at them because they're too loud. I yell at them because they're not being kind to each other. And I say that's not how you treat other people.
Right.
And trying to give them a sense of self-awareness. And how do kids learn self-awareness and how to be respectful unless a parent just drills it into them? And it does take drilling because kids are pretty thick.
Yeah, but okay, so Piper, that kind of brings me back to my point a little bit. So in other words, like my version of a well-behaved kid is going to be different. It was different. It is different than other parents' versions of well-behaved kids. So because a kid is having a good time, is being a little rambunctious, I feel like parents don't think that that's necessarily under the category of bad behavior because they're being a little like jumpy and loud. Whereas to me, like I always put that in the under the category of bad behavior because you're not being controlled, you're not being quiet, and you're not being you're not being respectful of the noise level of people around you. But I just don't know if everybody has the same line, right?
No, they don't. And most people, like, somebody is going to be furious at me for this.
And absolutely, okay. I'm super excited about that.
Completely comfortable with that. Children don't hold the same social status as adults. They hold the same human value as adults.
Right,
but
right.
If there are a group of like – say you're meeting as a group of friends or a church small group and you're sitting around as adults and you're conversing in an adult manner and a child comes charging into the room screaming, there's two kinds of parents. There are those who think that's a perfectly valid way to act because that child's voice should be heard as much as anybody else. And then there are those of us who say that is never appropriate behavior for a child. You don't interrupt. You can come, you know, tap me on the shoulder. I'll tell you to wait a second. I'll turn to you. We'll talk it out. And then you'll go on your way. But like that's the idea is some people just think kids have the same social status, which means they get to do whatever they want, with the assumption that they have the capability of making the same kinds of decisions adults do about how to behave.
Absolutely.
But kids are dumb.
Right.
Like, children are just not that bright, and they have no awareness of what's going on around them. So they just – to give them that freedom is to give free rein to somebody without
a
fully formed frontal lobe, to put it nicely.
That's it, man. That's it. Well, boys shifting gears drastically from that.
I feel even more confused now.
Yeah, I know.
Your child is 20. It's not that your work is done, but
you're out of the woods on that.
You either did your job or you didn't at this point, and too bad. Or congratulations.
I was an only child though, so I totally relate to the whole like tranquil, peaceful, quiet house.
Was that kind of your upbringing where everything?
Baby,
was a
that was
quiet,
totally my upbringing, man. Right. Our house was so chill and so quiet, and then
you're trying to navigate it with two.
I'm
kids.
Trying to navigate it, and when we introduced a second kid into our family, it was like, whoa, what's going on here? You know, my house wasn't like this. It was crazy, but boys, we had a listener write in and ask the question. I think it's a really good question, and maybe Big R, you can speak to this first. Why don't guys sing in church? So it's worship time. The words go on the overhead. The super hipster band starts playing. Everybody starts singing, and there's a lot of guys standing there just kind of stone-faced. And you know that these guys ostensibly love the Lord. You know, they're in church week after week, but they're not singing. Why is that? I think it's a really good question. It's a really, really interesting question.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of something that like dudes like me are you know, have been like in a quandary over and slightly perplexed about. But and by the way, you know, if you're super hipster, you don't do an overhead. You're like us. You go back to print because that's more hipster.
Dude, it's
like,
it's vintage. Yeah,
it's vintage. Yeah, we don't do overheads. Yeah, I think. Oh, so what I think it is really is just it's the lack of. It's the lack of emotive qualities that I would say most men don't possess, you know? So singing is a vulnerable thing. Singing in some ways kind of taps into to more of like a feminine quality. And I think guys just for them to have to be that exposed and to have to do something that is, you know, expressing themselves in a way that is not, you know, that is not aggressive. I think they just struggle with that. I think they absolutely just struggle with that. I mean, even as a guy talking to you guys right now, as a guy who made his living for years and years, like singing in front of audiences, that was different than singing in church. So there's different ways to go about that. So, you know, dudes have no problem with like driving down the road, singing to their favorite bands and artists and songs. But when you get into a church setting and you're singing songs that in general are about praising the Lord, that are about some of the vulnerable issues that we deal with, man, I just think it's antithetical to how men are created and built in some ways. And maybe it's just the way the culture has formed us and made us to be. I don't know, Pipe, what's your take on that?
Well, two things come to mind. I agree with what you just said. I think on a very practical level, I don't think most people grow up in a very musical context. Like singing is not a part of people's upbringing. And so like I grew up in church multiple times a week where music was part of that, but then I was also in music in school all the way up into high school. And so it doesn't seem as foreign to me, particularly the church culture side of things, though. But like we didn't sing as a family and things like that. We weren't a super musical family. But it's interesting that you say that singing is maybe a more feminine thing, or at least the expressive aspect of it, because I think historically that's not really true.
Probably.
And here's the thing: is like it's not true in the military. Like military cadences are songs. Now, granted, they're not terribly melodic, but there's
you're like stomping around with a gun when you're singing those, so it feels a little bit different.
Why don't we try that in church? Maybe if Donald Trump becomes president.
I think what you're saying is true. To interject here is that I think you know maybe what we're going to do now is define that there's been a problem with music culture in the church in terms of the songs that we're singing into a little bit more of that feminine element rather than songs that can be, you know, something that is going to be a little more masculine.
Guys can't sing in the key of Tomlin. Right. Like it's just and the love songs to Jesus are like there's a distinct difference between A Mighty Fortress Is Our God and like In the Secret, In the Quiet Place, which is like just the quintessential creepy love song for Jesus. And those are sort of the spectrums, and most churches have gone really happy clappy. I mean, there's a website called 538, which is it's statistical analysis. It's run by ESPN. Nate Silver is in charge of it, so he's the guy who's done all like the presidential election statistics and projections the last several years. They did a statistical analysis of Christian music.
Mm. Oh wow!
And basically what they came up with was it's all really happy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's what draws out expressions in guys the same way. There has to be some – it has to sound right for one thing. And so like that tinny, Tomlin-y kind of music is just not going to do it for a lot of guys. But it also has to tap into something powerful as opposed to kind of flimsy and cheesy and feely.
Right. Now, is Tomlin the one that looks like he bench presses Buicks? Am I thinking of the same guy?
No, Tomlin.
One of those guys is huge. You know what I'm talking about?
Tomlin's a little guy.
Oh, okay.
Who am I talking about? And here's the thing: is like his songs are pretty good songs lyrically, but like stylistically, they're in a key that's too high for the average guy to sing, and they're just sort of they're just kind of high pitched and soft.
Well, and again, then what happens is you get worship leaders or pastors that are also, you know, sensitive artists. And the trend over the last 15 years has been a higher range of vocalizing. And so that just bled into the church. So it's just being a higher singer that culture that's come out of pop music in general for men just bled into the church. It's not necessarily Tomlin. You could also blame that on Radiohead too, because in Coldplay, all these higher pitched singers that have come in, and that's kind of bled into the church for sure. But yeah, I think I really do think that lyrically, you know, this lack of sort of confessional type of songs, which again, the reform movement has kind of brought those back quite a bit, which has been good. Some of these darker, more confessional kind of songs that feel a little more, I hate to say masculine. I don't really know how better to describe them other than saying that they're tapping into emotions that feel a little bit more, that were written and driven by, I don't know, emotions that are going to feel a little more, They're going to feel a little more real, a little more that men are going to be drawn to, I would say.
I would say even the style of how they are played and the tunes themselves, like, just remove it from church music and go to like just pop radio. Most top 40 hits are bigger hits amongst women than they are men, and it's because they tend to be those they're upbeat, happy kinds of songs. You get like Pharrell's Happy, for example, which was the summer song of two summers ago or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, none of that stuff resonates with me. None of it.
Right.
But like soul music does, jazz does, blues does, songs with like that are heavy.
Yeah.
And they can even be like lyrically really positive, but they have some drive to them.
They have weight.
Yeah.
They have
some weight. There's very little of that in church music. At least in the modern worship movement.
Yeah. That's well said. I think it's a struggle too. I mean, Ted, what do you think about that, man? Because I mean, you've been through some, I know your story, having been in a few different churches the last half decade. I mean, what kind, and I know, you know, because we're friends, I know denominationally where some of these churches have, landed. What did you see kind of going through maybe some different cultures of music in these churches?
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, you know, the churches that we've been a part of over the last decade and a half, they've all been really solid theologically. The worship has all been, you know, robust in the sense that, you know, the songs are really thoughtful. The songs are really reflective of, you know, not only what, you know, life in a fallen world looks like, but what the gospel looks like in light of that. So, you know, you didn't get the sense that you were singing these, you know, kind of vapid, sappy love songs to Jesus. And honestly, for me, all kidding aside, like, you know, over the last decade or so, like, I've really come to enjoy worship, because I think, you know, growing up, I was probably more of the stand there and just gut it out until it's over kind of guy, you know, in part because it was the Midwest, and in part because, you know, like the tough guy athlete thing. I mean, you know, there was no encouragement to just stand there and like sing my heart out. You know what I mean? But yeah, worship, I would say, has become a lot more meaningful as I've been led in it by some really good, really authentic people. And in none of these churches has worship been a performance. You know, I think, you know, being the cynic that I am, one of the things that I hate the most is the sense that, you know, I'm sort of being pandered to or entertained or like, you know, led in worship by a bunch of hot, insincere people. Like, that's not what I want at all. So, the churches have been different. The styles have been a little bit different, but I think the heart has been the same at each of them, where, you know, it's just really authentic people who want to honor the Lord with their music. And, you know, they're not perfect. They're not doing everything, you know, exactly, you know, strictly by the book or whatever. It's not plastic.
Right, and I think what you're saying is if the content is driving those other things, ultimately men will attach themselves to the content.
There's a leadership style that goes with that is just it is authentic in the sense of a person up front just being themselves. They're not sort of like the whispery, wispy worship leader, you know, who introduces songs and let's go to Jesus, you know, and you're like, I don't even know what that means. They speak from the heart, and then they go into music and they sing their hearts out. That's another thing. I mean, it's one thing if a worship leader hits every note, but if they sing their heart out, it's a lot easier to sing with them because they cover up your mistakes. You don't like, they're setting the tone of authentic, expressive worship without trying to be perfect or sing in a way that you can't or whatever it is. And I completely agree with what Ted just said in terms of the pretty people putting on a performance versus just that somebody who's maybe not perfect, but they're just, they're kind of charging into worship.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, boys, we're going to set yet more records for randomness.
Yes.
In podcast topics here today. This was another listener suggested topic, and this person wanted to know what our favorite cartoons were from childhood. So thinking back, man, to those idyllic days
of Saturday morning cartoons,
of Saturday morning cartoons, of
keeping
watching
the depth actual, alive here on the rant,
of watching actual TV, which our kids probably know nothing of, TV with commercials and you know shows that you have to watch at certain times. What were your favorite cartoons, boys?
Mm. Ronnie, I feel like you had a deep love affair with certain cartoons.
Yeah, dude, you know what, man? I'm just trying to think of what I watch. I think if I had to pick one that sticks out, this might be just a couple years before your guys' time. I don't really know, but it would be there was this cartoon program called The Super Friends that came on in the early to mid 80s. Yeah, and so it was you know, and again, I'm not like a comic book guy, so I don't know if it was Marvel or DC. You know, I don't know who was informing it and all those types of things. But, you know, it was just so you had like your standard cast, I think, of like Batman and Robin and Wonder Woman. And then you had some bizarro.
Some fringers. They bring in like Aquaman every once in a while.
Aquaman, or the one I'm thinking of was the Wonder Twins were on it.
Yes.
Who I don't think, I don't think they were at the height of superhero popularity through the ages. And so I don't know. It was just because I liked the whole superhero thing back in the day. So, yeah. So they would have their standard guys on there that everybody had heard of. And then they'd bring in these fringy superheroes that I was always really fascinated with, you know, being kind of an underdog guy. I really loved to see what they were about to do and what they were going to
do.
Yeah,
you get a little Green Lantern like once a month.
Little Green Lantern with the ring and the whole deal. Yeah, so I liked that. And then there were just weird ones. Like, remember the Smurfs, you know, that I felt like I was forced to watch because my little sister loved it. And, you know, stuff that was like you sat there and you watched it. You didn't love it. But, you know, you could always have that fourth bowl of cereal and that would kind of keep you going through it while your parents were up there sleeping. And
Calvin and Hobbes existence.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it was just I think there's even more than just favorite cartoons. There was that culture of like when you're young and before you started sleeping in late and you actually woke up early on Saturdays, and there was nothing greater than having just unaltered bowls of cereal after cereal while you're watching program after program.
You got access to the TV. What more do you need?
Exactly. You know? You're like living the life that only your dad would be living at every other time of the day or at the night. You know,
your dad would be living if he didn't have you, you know, ironically.
I didn't grow up with a TV. So like that experience for me was, it was even more of a mountaintop experience because it was like, it was when I would spend the night at friends' houses or be on vacation or something like that. So, I mean, I remember we would get a timeshare at Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and spend a week at the beach for vacation or something. And it would be that experience, you know, so everybody else is sleeping and I'd get up and do this. And the show that I loved more than any, and I still think this is the best cartoon, is Animaniacs.
Wow.
Okay. Animaniacs was...
That's a Spielberg thing, right?
It was. And it didn't work because it was put on during like Saturday morning cartoons, but it's really an adult cartoon. Like
it was too clever, wasn't it?
Most of the jokes are there are too many cultural references, there are too many different things. And I was a little bit too old for like for the typical Saturday morning cartoons, you know, the Smurfs and whatever else. Like because this was, you know, it was probably when I was, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. And but Animaniacs, I was just old enough to start to understand those jokes and get how clever it was. And I went back and started watching it with my kids, and they didn't get it at all. And I was rolling.
You loved it.
It's still hilarious. It. Yeah. And then other than that, I mean, for me, it was like there was some of the Batman cartoons were cool, but just the classics, like Looney Tunes, just the classic Looney Tunes, always a favorite.
Dude, those are hard to beat. Those are hard to beat. I mean, yeah, there was some, you know, and what's funny is when you go back to the cartoons of like the early classic cartoons, like that was total adult humor on those things.
Yes.
You know, it's remarkable that like kids even locked into those.
With enough slapstick that a 6-year-old is going to bust their gut because, you know, Daffy Duck gets hit in the head with a hammer or something like that.
Right, right.
I liked like Tailspin and DuckTales and some of those as well. But
see,
like,
that's a generation after ours, Big R. You know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And again, I think I was a little bit old for those, but they had enough sort of. They had enough cleverness that I didn't think they were like childish and kiddy at that time. But Animaniacs still takes the cake as my favorite.
Yeah, and cartoons have come a long way. Like I remember when Bethy was watching cartoons, and there was one that I loved, man. I used to wait for it. It was called Recess. And it was just the story of these like fourth and fifth graders at school. But the humor was it's like they wrote it for adults and somehow kids could lock into it as well. But those always really fascinated me because it was like, no, let's sit down and watch Recess right now. Like I'm stoked. Let me go grab some food and something to drink. Like we're going to make like a thing out of this. This is going to be the daddy daughter moment that we remember like throughout all time. And I think it kind of still is.
If only you had Instagram.
I know. If only I could have done a photo journal like I did at the Indians Rangers game the other night. You know, if only I had that power and I didn't.
Okay,
Big R, do you remember a cartoon called He-Man?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, AKA the most homoerotic thing ever made.
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was
that makes the volleyball scene in Top Gun look like a church thing. You know,
oh, absolutely.
In terms of being homoerotic, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. It was, I mean, and to be honest, Big T, I mean, when you go back to like the early to mid 80s, there were a lot of cartoons with just some really, really strange overtones. If you go back,
there really were.
I'm pretty sure those inspired Ace and Gary, the ambiguously gay duo. I'm pretty sure that was drawn straight from like that was SNL, right?
I'm pretty sure that was
from their childhood cartoon experiences.
I'm sure.
I don't doubt it.
Big R, remember Thundercats?
Yeah, like I know Thundercats, but that wasn't one. Again, now remember, I was fighting with a brother and a sister for cartoon time. Just not one that it was there, but it never got locked into. But I know
it. Heavy rotation. When I was a little kid, I was heavy into wrestling, like pro wrestling, like WWF pro wrestling. And there was a cartoon version of that where like the good guys and the bad guys from actual wrestling, which is a fake thing. So there is no actual wrestling, but they would have these little scenarios. They'd be like fighting crime. So you'd have like Hulk Hogan and like Andre the Giant, like in a, you know, in a van going out to like, you know, solve the caper of the bank heist or whatever. I love that thing, man.
Well,
that was good times.
Yeah. There's kind of like an innocence too, I think, to some of the old cartoons. I feel like when you, if I ever catch like a modern cartoon, I feel. These cartoons and like be mimicking like the, you know, sort of like the attitude that these things like put out there. You know what I mean? So maybe it's because I'm getting old. I'm getting all grandpa about it now, but they seem really cynical and snarky. Now, not all of them, but some of them that I've been able to watch in recent years. I don't know.
They're not terribly upbeat. It's not a cartoon, but I think it came right after cartoons on Saturday mornings, and it may as well have been a cartoon because all the characters were so fake, was American Gladiators.
Oh, dude, that was classic.
They basically look like plastic people, so I'm pretty sure it had a cartoon aspect. But yes, absolute, complete, and total classic. I had the action figures and everything, you know, with like
the little
zip lines and their the little jousting pads and all that. That was so phenomenal.
Yeah, I don't have any experience with that. Yeah, I don't have any experience with that.
Yeah, Big R, it was all these like steroidal, like freakish people. Who probably barely made the cut. Like they weren't good looking enough to be models and they weren't quite athletic enough to be like pro athletes. So they created this platform from them, which was, they would get dressed in spandex and like,
and it was all red, white and blue stuff.
It was all red, white and blue, very patriotic. So they'd be like climbing over walls and like hitting each other with those huge sticks
they would compete against contestants. So they would have they would bring in like, This is Roger. He's a former Division I running back, and Roger's going to compete against, you know, Steve over here, who's a, you know, he's an accountant, but on the weekends he's a bodybuilder or whatever. And and they would run this obstacle course with the gladiators essentially being their opponents and trying to stop them. So wow. they would have to like run through tackling dummies, and they would get on these, you know, these like stanchions and have to joust with these pads and try to knock the other person off. And yeah. and all of them are just roided up and spray tanned and oiled.
Spray tanned and like oiled and
you the like late 80s, early 90s mullets. And I think they all have the exact same haircut.
Boys, it sounds like a dream. I don't know. I'm sorry I missed it. It sounds like an absolute joy.
You too.
Yeah, it really was.
You will go into a deep, dark hole of amazingness. Coma? It's amazing. You would love it.
Yeah. Well, boys, we've truly wandered to and fro from worship style to parenting to steroids and spandex from the 80s, guys. It gets no better than this. And we appreciate the boys at Resonate Recordings for making us sound good. There was a little choppiness there with the audio at the end. Those guys will work their magic on that.
And you, listener, will never know it existed.
They'll never know it existed. They don't know what we go through.
They don't even know what we're talking about right now, Big T. They literally have no concept of what you're saying.
I want them to know how we suffer for this medium. You know what I mean? They see just the glitz and the glamour and the hipster coffee shop gigs in Louisville and the T-shirts that we're probably never going to get for missional wear. That's all they see, you know?
Speaking of hipster coffee shops, one listener did call out Ronnie. So Ronnie posted a sermon preparation photo of what looked like multiple moleskins and a Bible and pens at a picnic table with sort of a lush green background.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I'm not on social media. They wanted you to defend your hipster photo. And I responded and said, I'm not sure that's actually hipster because there's no coffee in the picture. And they responded back and said, well, true hipsters never put down their coffee, so it couldn't be in the picture.
Wow.
Ronnie, what do you have to say for yourself, Mr. Sermon Prep at the picnic table?
Well, number one, those were not moleskins. That was courtesy of Saddleback leather. And, I didn't have any coffee.
Is that even more expensive than moleskin? Like, oh, each page is leather.
Oh, like yeah, each page is leather. That. Yeah, I mean, I had about $4,000 worth of like journals sitting there on that
dead goats
picnic table. Yeah, I have no defense. That was not a hipster photo, and a true hipster would have known that was not a hipster pick.
Yeah, I didn't strike me as hipster. It did strike me as sort of it was like the reflective pastor photo.
It was very reflective and idyllic, and a guy that is just getting ready to preach in a few days and has nothing. Like all preachers that have to preach in a few days. So that's what that was.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that. So listeners, you particularly the one who called that out, you need to get your hipster radar tuned in a little bit better.
Right. So listeners, back off. Back
that's
off.
Good. That's iron sharpening iron. That's hipster sharpening hipster.
I mean, if you want to see some hipsterness, you need to come to Live in Louisville because we're going to be in the town for which hipsterness was practically invented, and you're going to get just a large dose of it. So, again, that's just another opportunity for us to promo Live in Louisville, October 23rd. And we need to see a turnout for this, don't we, fellas? We need to see people literally getting in their cars and committing to come to a city of which they're either familiar or unfamiliar with and supporting our podcast. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
I think so.
Absolutely.
And I would say by first week in August, we will have something up online where people can start to – reserve some spots for that. So we will commit to have that up by the first week in August. Probably use Eventbrite for it, and we'll put it up at the Blazing Center so people can start to find their way to that.
Absolutely.
I love it. Boys, I can't wait. It's going to be magical is what it's going to be. It's going to be like American Gladiators minus the steroids and the spandex and the
Why do you say minus?
Well, it doesn't have to be minus. I'm keeping an open mind.
Steroids are expensive. I think we can do the spray tans and the mullets and the unitards.
Dude, we'll do an American Gladiators app. We'll do a Kenta Culvey app. You know, themes. Al Mohler,
yep.
I love it. Well, boys, we truly have wandered to and fro. It has been a pleasure, as it always is. And, Pipe, I saw that Rachel Held Evans is going after your pops again on Twitter. So...
Yep.
So until next time, big sighs and Rachel the Held Evans.
Scripture and brain science agree. Meditating on God's word transforms us and reduces stress in our lives. I'm Jody Nisnik, host of So Much More, Creating Space for God. a scripture meditation podcast. And each week I give you space to hear God's word, listen to the Spirit, and pray about what's on your heart. And then we have a thoughtful conversation with guests to help us go deeper. Listen and subscribe at lifeaudio.com.